So the title of the talk is either Reverend Ezra Stiles and the Jews of Newport, Rhode Island, or the Reverend Ezra Stiles. I never know whether you're supposed to say the Reverend or just Reverend. No, they're called the Reverend. First of all, who was Ezra Stiles? Ezra Stiles was born in 1727. He passed away in 1795. He was an American academic, an educator, a congregational minister, a theologian, and an author. And he was president of Yale College from 1778 to 1795. He was a minister in Newport, Rhode Island, and while he was there, he showed a great interest in the Jews who were living there. In fact, he studied Hebrew and even included Hebrew in the Yale emblem, which I passed around. We'll come back to Stiles once we've traced the development of the Jewish community of Newport, Rhode Island. Stiles gives us tremendous insight into what was going on with the Jewish community at the time that he was there. It's fascinating because he kept a diary. He was a big diarist and he recorded many, many, many things. But first, let's talk a little bit about how the Jews came to Newport, what they were doing there, and the community that was there. So first of all, in 1636, Roger Williams, after he was thrown out of Massachusetts, came to Providence, and he founded a colony there with a few of his followers. And this became known as the Colony of Rhode Island, and it was unique because it allowed for religious freedom. And as a result, Quakers, Baptists, Jews, and other persecuted minorities settled there because they could practice their religion openly, which was not the case in many of the other colonies. Puritans of Massachusetts came to Massachusetts for religious freedom, but they didn't allow anybody else to have any religious freedom. You had to follow their way, or that was it. It's not clear exactly when the first Jews came to Newport. First of all, the first Jews came to North America. They settled in 1654 in New York. Some say that the Jews came to Newport in 1656, 1657, or 1658. There's no real agreement, but everybody agrees that those who settled originally came from Holland, although they had been in the New World and they had left Brazil when the Portuguese recaptured that in 1654 and had gone to certain islands and then went to Newport. What was the attraction? Newport was a marvelous port for trade. And Jews always, if you look at the migrations of Jews, they followed, in general, the trade route. The total number of Jews that settled in Newport was very small, probably no more than 15 Spanish-Portuguese families. By the way, they were refugees from the Inquisition. They had escaped from the Inquisition in both Spain and Portugal. That's why many, many Jews came to the New World. So in August then of 1694, a number of additional Jewish families settled in Newport. They probably came from Curacao, which had a Jewish community. By the way, in the Caribbean, in all those little islands, there were Jewish communities, interestingly enough. All Jewish communities. Now, once they settled there, they immediately began to establish the institutions necessary for Jewish life. They had regular services, although they did not have a synagogue. They prayed for almost 100 years in various people's homes. They, in 1677, they bought a piece of land which was used as a Jewish cemetery. That cemetery still exists and is well maintained because of a gift from somebody by the name of Abraham Turo, whose brother is Judo Turo. Both of them were wealthy bachelors who had much money when they passed away. Judo Turo left money to maintain the synagogue in Newport, and Abraham Turo to maintain the cemetery. The cemetery still exists. Now, that's not the first cemetery that the Jews had in America. When the Jews came here in 1654, shortly thereafter, they had a cemetery, but we don't know where it is. This one is the oldest maintained. And by the way, the synagogue is a historic site. And it's worth a trip to Newport. First of all, there are the mansions also in Newport to see. And it's worth a trip to Newport to sort of see this whole thing. I understand that they're opening some sort of new Jewish historical center across from the synagogue. Okay. So they established right away, they had regular services. First of all, let's understand that all Jews virtually at that time were either members of the observant Jewish community or were out of it. There was no in-between. There was no in-between. There was nothing like halfway. You were either in or you were out, basically. And these people were in, they were observant Jews. Now, in the 18th century, additional families began to arrive. Lopez, Rivera, by the way, these names don't necessarily sound Jewish because these are Spanish Portuguese Jews. Nunes, Sheshes, Lopez, okay. Somebody after I spoke about Aaron Lopez said to me, gee, I didn't know that J-Lo was Jewish. I couldn't know that. I didn't know that. So Lopez, Rivera, Pollock, Hart, and the Hayes families, all Jews, settled in the city and it entered an era of prosperity. It was generally conceded that Newport had every advantage. Wealth had centered here and was attracting capitalists from every part of the world. Between 1750 and 1760, some hundreds of wealthy Israelites, this is absolutely an exaggeration. There were never hundreds of Israelites living in Newport in the 18th century, but many. A most distinguished class of merchants removed from Spain, Portugal, Jamaica, and other places and entered largely into business. One of them, Mr. Aaron Lopez. I think I spoke about Aaron Lopez here once, but who remembers? It's on the website that I have here. But anyway, Aaron Lopez was a refugee from Portugal. He came here. He had been raised as a secret Jew. He immediately, when he came to America, became an observant Jew. He was the wealthiest merchant probably during colonial times.
Is he was a self-circumciser?
No, that's you're thinking about the fellow in Mexico.
Same name.
No, I don't think so. Spanish name. No. Lopez was not circumcised, of course, when he was in Portugal. And this was typical, by the way, of the Jews who were able to get out of Portugal. He came here with a wife, Lopez, and he remarried her according to Jewish law. His name was Duarte originally, and then he began to use his Hebrew name, and he had himself circumcised. And he was an observant Jew because we have somebody who writes that I wanted to see you on a certain day, but was told that you're not conducting business because it is the Passover festival. And okay, he shipped kosher meat to the Caribbean. So he was a well-to-do, and there were others who were very well-to-do. They were involved in the manufacture of sperm oil and candles, which was introduced by the Jews of Newport from Lisbon between 1745 and 1750. And from that time to 1760, there was put in full operation 17 factories for these articles alone, and 22 distilleries, and sugar factories, and rope factories, and many furniture factories. And they shipped all over the New World. The Jewish merchant princes were not merely the capitalists who furnished the wherewithal for this trade, but their enterprise created the trade itself, introduced the new arts and industries involved, and furnished the trade connections through their co-religionists in the different foreign ports with which the relations were formed. The Jews had connections all over the world, family connections, cousin or this or that, and that's how they did business. That's how they did business all over the world. The Jews in general of Newport participated in the life of the city, and they were viewed very favorably by their non-Jewish neighbors. One non-Jewish writer wrote the following. The Jews who settled in Newport were not only noted for their knowledge of mercantile and commercial affairs, but also for their industry, enterprise, and probity. They kept to their callings, took but little part in politics, at least there was no evidence that they gave much attention to the discussion of public questions, and they seem to have avoided both the marine and military service. They were neither good sailors nor good soldiers, nor do they appear to have been very fond of books. Moses Lopez and Jacob Joseph, it is true, were numbered among the founders of the Redwood Library, that was a public library. In 1758, Jacob Rodriguez Rivera was a stockholder in that institution. But this may be taken as one of many evidences of the desire to promote whatever promised to be of public benefit. Their business, with but few exceptions, they made a success. And in all things appertaining to their devotions, they were exact, which means that they were observant. They were careful in terms of what they did, in terms of what Judaism required. Now, the American Revolution destroyed this. Newport was a bustling, tremendous port. It was a beautiful location. People today think of it as a place to go in the summer for a vacation, but it was a lovely location for all of this commercial activity. And Newport was a prime target of the British. And when they captured Newport, many of the residents left. First of all, merchants in general were pro the Revolutionary War cause. They were anti-British. They were anti the tax. So they left, and that led to the decline of everything that was going on there. And sadly enough, it was never reestablished. After the Revolution, very few came back for a variety of reasons, and Newport actually went very much down in terms of its Jewish community. So much so that in 1858, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow wrote a poem about the Jewish cemetery at Newport, in which he wrote in part, "Closed are the portals of their synagogue. No Psalms of David now the silence break. No rabbi reads the ancient Decalogue. In the grand dialect the prophet spake. Gone are the living, but the dead remain, and not neglected, for a hand unseen, scattering its bounty like a summer rain, still keeps their graves and their remembrance green." Actually, the hand is Abraham Turow. And there's a gentleman named Isaac Turow, who was the chazan, the service leader of the Turow Synagogue prior to the Revolutionary War and until the Jews left. But Isaac Turow made a mistake. He sided with the British. And the overwhelming number of Jews, as I said, sided with the Revolutionary War cause. So he stayed. In fact, then he went to New York and he lived off of a pension from the British. But once the British lost the war, he left the country, went to Jamaica. He stayed there for a year and then passed away. His two sons, Abraham and Judah, were left poverty-stricken. They went and lived in Boston with an uncle. They both got involved in business, and Judah Turow made a huge fortune. He gave away in the 1850s over $500,000 he had to give. That's real, real money, and he gave it to a huge number of causes. Again, Abraham Turow put up money to maintain the cemetery, and Judah Turow put up money to maintain the synagogue, so that's why it's called the Turow Synagogue. Now let's turn to Reverend Ezra Stiles, and then we're going to put them together. Reverend Ezra Stiles was born on November 29, 1727 in Connecticut. He graduated from Yale University in 1746. He then studied theology at Yale and was ordained in 1749. He worked as a tutor for a year after he was ordained and then began some mission work among the Indians. But in 1752, he had to give this up because of ill health, and he then studied law. And in 1753, he took the attorney's oath and practiced law in New Haven until 1755. In 1755, he returned to the ministry, accepting the position of pastor of the Second Congregational Church in Newport, Rhode Island, where he served from 1755 until 1777. Why 1777? Because he was also pro the revolution, and he fled too. He fled too. Okay. Now, his Hebrew studies. Stiles was an intellect. He was an academic. He eventually became president of Yale. And he earned a doctorate in theology from Edinburgh, but then he began to think, how can I be an educated minister if I can't read the Hebrew Bible in its original? After all, there's a huge amount that's lost in translation. And by the way, what you have today in the English, what the King James Bible, whatever it is a translation of a translation of a translation of a translation, right? It's translated from Hebrew into Greek, from Greek into Latin, and then from Latin into presumably English. So it really is far away. It's far away. And Hebrew is a very nuanced language, and a little change in the structure of a word can imply huge meaning and huge, huge hints. In addition to that, let me just point out the Jewish view of the Hebrew Bible. You know, when our students come to class, they take notes, hopefully. And they can write, jot down certain things. And then when they go back and look at that, a certain little sentence like this, or part of a sentence, or a phrase, or this or that, is supposed to conjure up all sorts of memories of what happened in the lecture, right? They don't. That's what note-taking is, a little this, a little that's a hint. The Jewish view of the Hebrew Bible is that it's the same thing. It is meant, it's never meant to be read by itself. One needs what's called the oral tradition to understand what it means. Let me give one simple example. V'hayula totofos bein einecha, and they shall be for totofos between your eyes. What, pray tell, are totofos? The translation is phylacteries. That's Hebrew for tefillin. What do phylacteries look like? They're black boxes. They have certain verses written on parchment in them. And one goes on the arm, one goes in. None of this is described in the Hebrew Bible. Not a word there. Just v'hayula totofos bein einecha. The oral tradition, the Talmud, explains all of the nuances and all of the things that are involved. So really, people don't like to hear this too much when I say this, but you can't really read the Bible unless you have the whole panorama of background. In any case, Stiles became interested in learning Hebrew. He felt, as an educated man, he should. In May 1767, Dr. Stiles knew 10 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. He therefore requested one of his Jewish friends to teach him the others. He was in contact with the Jews. He lived not far from the synagogue that we'll talk about later that was built. Unlike some modern students of that ancient tongue, he determined, before beginning to translate from it into English, to read the language fluently, and henceforth read 10 pages of the Psalter every day before breakfast in Hebrew. On the last of January of the next year, he began to translate Genesis, and by May 12th had finished it and Exodus. By the end of the year, he had read Ezra and some of the Chaldee and Daniel, reading one chapter of the Bible in a little Arabic daily except on Sundays. Didn't read the Hebrew Bible on Sundays. That's interesting to me, but he felt that wasn't appropriate, obviously. Thus, he finished the Bible in October of 1770. As was most natural, he compared his translation with the authorized version and found the latter an excellent rendering, requiring corrections in but few places. He now continued his Hebrew studies and became so proficient that in 1773, the year he met Rabbi Chaim Isaac Karagal, Rabbi Chaim Yitzchak Karagal, who we'll talk about a little bit, he wrote a Hebrew letter of 22 pages to him on the divinity of the Messiah. In 1774, he read Unklus, that's a classic Aramaic commentary on the Bible, and Jonathan in the original, and in 1777, we find him, according to his biographer, reading Chaldee and Targum, that's another commentary. In July 1778, when he was inducted into his office as president of Yale, he delivered, as his inauguration speech, he delivered it in Hebrew. Spoke in Hebrew at Yale, that was not. So he learned the language. Now, because of his interest in the Hebrew language, because of his interest in the Hebrew Bible, it was only natural that he should come in contact and be involved with the Jews. After all, they were, he lived a very short distance from the location of the Toro Synagogue, and he became friendly with many of them, with many of them. When he needed explanation of certain things in Hebrew in his studies, he would consult with them. He kept a diary. Beginning on January 1st, 1769, Dr. Stiles began keeping a diary, making regular entries until shortly before his death. One is struck at once upon taking up the diary by the large number of references to Jews and to Jewish affairs. Although they are almost all confined to the period of his residence at Newport, the first entry about the Jews occurs as early as March 16, 1769, which day he tells us he spent mostly with the, quote, Jew priest, unquote, Isaac the Abraham Turo. That's Isaac Turo, who was the father of Judah and Abraham Turo, and who was the chazan, who was the service leader, the cantor. I have trouble translating into English sometimes. Forgive me. He was the cantor of the Turo synagogue. They were a discussion on biblical prophecies. From that time until the outbreak of the revolution, which, when it began, absorbed almost all his thoughts, scarcely a month passes without some entry referring either to conversations or to correspondence with Jews, or to discussions on religious questions with them, or to items of interest regarding Jews. On December 2, 1763, Dr. Stiles attended the dedication of what is today known as the Turo Synagogue. Among his papers, there is an elaborate description of the services as well as of the building. And this is invaluable to historians because it tells us what actually happened. It tells us what went on. Reverend Stiles was particularly interested in discussing theological and religious matters with the various rabbis who visited Newport. Now, the first rabbi to settle permanently in America did not settle until 1840. Again, the Jews came here in 1754. There was no resident rabbi, Orthodox ordained rabbi, in America until 1840. The cantors, the chazonim, served the role of congregational leadership as well as various laymen who had better Jewish educations. But six rabbis came to Newport, and he met with all of them, and he describes them. But the one he found most fascinating is a gentleman by the name of Rabbi Raphael Chaim Yitzchak Karagau. Rabbi Raphael Chaim, how do you say? Chaim is Chaim. Yitzchak is Isaac. Karagal is his last name, 1732 to 1777. He himself is a fascinating character. He was born in Israel, and he was educated there. And he received ordination at the age of 18. He was a brilliant scholar. So he was a fountain of knowledge for somebody like Reverend Stiles, because he knew his stuff. He knew much more, say, than the average Jew who lived in Newport. And he began then, in 1754, he was appointed as a messenger for the community of Hebron in Israel, which meant he traveled throughout the world collecting money to support the people who lived there. So he traveled extensively. He was in Egypt, Turkey, Syria, Iraq, Persia, Italy, Germany, Prague, Vienna, London, and Amsterdam. Now, keep in mind, we're talking about traveling in the 18th century. You didn't get on an airplane, obviously. It was really quite difficult to go anywhere, okay? He served for a short time, for a couple of years, as a rabbi of the Jewish community of Curacao. In 17, then he went back to Hebron, to his family, and then in 1768, he again took up his travels, going to France and then London. After visiting Jamaica, he set sail for North America, visiting Philadelphia and New York, and on March 3rd, 1773, he arrived in Newport, Rhode Island, where he stayed until July 21st in 1773. When Reverend Stiles learned of Carrigal's arrival in Newport, he immediately wanted to meet him. And he knew that coming up was the Jewish holiday of Purim. Purim is a joyous celebration of the rescue of the Jews. It's in the book of Esther. It describes how Esther and Mordechai were able to rescue the Jews from the wicked Haman, as he's called. And although it's not a biblical festival, it is something that plays an important role in the Jewish calendar. By the way, Hanukkah is also not a biblical holiday. Those are not biblical holidays. So he knew at Purim, he knew that Purim was on April 8th. No, he knew that Purim was on March 8th, so he went to the synagogue because he knew there he would meet Karagal. And sure enough, he was there, and Reverend Stiles gives us a detailed description of how he was dressed. I'm only going to read a little bit of it because it's long. By the way, if you go to my website and you click on the faculty forum link, you will find then a link to this talk. The talk actually will be there because I'm going to take this and put it into MP3 format. I can do that easily with this, but also the notes that I'm using are there if anybody's actually interested. The rabbi's dress or apparel: common English shoes, black leather, silver flowered buckles, white stockings. His general habit was Turkish. A green silk vest or long undergarment reached down more than halfway the legs or within 3 inches of the ankles. The ends of the sleeves of this vest appeared on the wrists in a foliage turnip of 3 inches, and the opening little larger than the hand might pass freely. A girdle or sash of different colors, red and green, girt the vest around his body. It appeared not to be open at the bottom but to come down like a petticoat, and no breeches could be discovered. The vest, however, had an opening above the girdle, and he put in his handkerchief and snuff box and watch. Under this was an inner vest of calico, besides other Jewish talismans, which means he was wearing the traditional, what are called tzitzis, that I have here, the ritual fringes, that is part of a four-cornered garment that is worn traditionally by Jews. And he goes on and on and on and on, describe every little thing in detail. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable. By the way, what's striking, he also says he had a long black beard, the upper lip partly shaven, his head shaved all over. Couldn't be that his head was shaved all over, because I'm sure he certainly had the side curls that are common amongst the Sephardic Jews. On the head, a high fur sable cap, exactly like a woman's muff, and about 9 or 10 inches high, and the aperture atop was closed with green cloth. He behaved modestly and reverently. First of all, what's striking is that he dressed colorfully. If you look around at all the pictures you see of Jews, you see black, 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 black. That is the custom of the Ashkenazic Jews, of the Jews from Europe, but it's not the custom of the Oriental Jews. They dressed in a flashy way, in at least until recently. Now, so Stiles spent time with Rabbi Karigal, and actually Rabbi Karigal not only, and by the way, Stiles attended synagogue on every festival, Passover and Shavuos, Pentecost. Every festival he attended, he was there, and he recorded what he saw. He recorded it all, and it provides us with a rich background of material. Now let's talk a little bit about... Oh, by the way, Stiles was so taken with Rabbi Karigal that he had his portrait painted, and we have that picture. We have that picture, but he was so taken with him that he had his portrait painted. Now let's talk a little bit about the building and the dedication of the Newport Touro Synagogue, which again is a historic site. I sent Harold a picture of the inside. You can see it's not such a big building. So the Jewish community was never that huge. Oh, Harold's got a picture yet. Very good. Thank you. Thank you. So if you are in Newport and you want to see something interesting, I believe that there are tours and stuff. It's very interesting. By the way, let's understand, the synagogue has added to it a school classroom building. That was part of it. And in addition, behind it, although it's no longer there, was an area that was used for the ritual slaughter of cattle and fowl, which is necessary to maintain the kosher laws. And not far from it is a house, which one cannot get into, which contains what is called a mikveh, a ritualarium. This is a facility that is used by women as part of their observance of the family purity laws. And this mikveh is in the basement. The synagogue sold the building in 1954, and I'm told that the guy who owns it won't let anybody in to see it. But the point is that they had everything they needed in terms of Jewish religious life. For the first 100 years, the Jewish community worshipped in private homes. They didn't have a synagogue. They were a relatively small group. In fact, all Jewish communities until the middle, or even the, say the first third, until about 1840, when the Bavarian Jews began to come in some sort of numbers, were relatively small. In 1700, the Jewish community of New York, which was considered a big Jewish community, consisted of 300 souls. That 300 people, that was the whole Jewish community. So a community of, say, 100 people was a substantial community. By the year 1754, Newport Jewry had organized itself into a congregation, which was called Nefutzos Yisrael, the Scattered of Israel. It was later changed to Yeshuot Yisrael, the Salvation of Israel. By 1759, the congregation had sufficiently increased to undertake the building of a synagogue, which would also incorporate provision for the religious instruction of the young. They were concerned with that. As this was an ambitious undertaking beyond the means of the community, an appeal was addressed to other congregations for funds. This was, by the way, the method that was used by many congregations, many synagogue buildings that were built in America prior to the middle 1800s, that appeals went out to Jewish communities all over the world, and people contributed. It's interesting to note that the letter of appeal to Congregation Sherith Israel in New York, that's the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue here in New York, which exists today, of course in a different location from where it originally existed, but it's still around today, made reference to the urgency of procuring proper facilities for educational purposes. The response was positive, and in June of 1759, they purchased a piece of land, and construction proceeded as money came in. The architect for the work was the renowned Peter Harrison. He was apparently a famous architect in colonial times. There is no record of his ever having asked for or receiving payment for his work, which is interesting. It must have been a labor of love to him. With consummate skill, he applied his great talents to his assignment and succeeded in erecting a synagogue of outstanding beauty, dignity, and impressiveness. The construction began again in 1759, proceeded in stages, and finally, on December 2nd, Friday, December 2nd, 1763, the synagogue was dedicated. It was the second day of the Jewish festival of Hanukkah, and guess who was there to describe what went on? None other than the Reverend Ezra Stiles. And we have quite an extensive discussion. December 2nd, 1763, Friday, in the afternoon, was the dedication of the new synagogue of this town. It began by a handsome procession in which were carried the books of the law, talking about the Torah scrolls, to be deposited in the ark. Several portions of scripture and of their service with a prayer for the royal family were read and finally sung by the priest, the chazan, Isaac Toro, and the people. There were present many gentlemen and ladies. The order and decorum, the harmony and solemnity of the music, together with a handsome assembly of people in a edifice, the most perfect of the temple kind perhaps in America, and splendidly illuminated, could not but raise in the mind the faint idea of the majesty and grandeur of the ancient Jewish worship mentioned in Scripture. Dr. Isaac de Abraham Toro performed the service. The synagogue is about perhaps 40 feet long and 30 wide, of brick on a foundation of freestone. It was begun about 2 years ago and is now finished except the porch and the capitals of the pillars. The front representation of the Holy of Holies, or its partition veil, consists only of waistcoated breastwork on the east end, in the lower part of which four long doors cover an upright square closet, the depth of which is about a foot or the thickness of the wall, and in this apartment, vulgarly called the Ark, that's what we call it, it's called the Ark in English, the Oren in Hebrew, were deposited three copies and rolls of the Pentateuch, that's the Torah. By the way, one of them is still there, I believe, in the Torah synagogue, you can actually see it. Okay, written on vellum, or rather tan calfskin. One of these rolls, I was told by Dr. Tour, was presented from Amsterdam and is 200 years old, and the letters have the rabbinical flourishes in the Torah, in the Hebrew Bible. When it's written by hand, there are various crowns and things on each letter. A gallery for the women runs round the whole inside. except the east end supported by columns of Ionic order, over which are placed correspondent columns of the Corinthian order supporting the ceiling of the roof. The depth of the Corinthian pedestal is the height of the balustrade, which runs round the gallery. The pulpit for reading the law is raised pew with an extended front table. This placed about the center of the synagogue or nearer the west end, being a square in balustraded, comporting with the length of the indented channel before it and at the foot of the ark. So he really describes everything that went on, what it looked like. He obviously spent time. I mean, how did he know that it was this deep in the ark? He must have gone over and looked at it, etc. So the Touro Synagogue in colonial times was the center of a vibrant Jewish life. And Stiles describes much of it. But as I said before, once the British captured Newport, almost all Jews left. Services ceased. The Jewish community never returned. In fact, the synagogue was rarely used for more than 100 years. Occasionally, if somebody was in some way related to somebody who was connected to the synagogue, actually ownership of the synagogue was transferred to the Sherith Israel Synagogue here in Manhattan, which is the first congregation in America, in New York, who the people who started that came here in 1754. And it was abandoned and it was forgotten. But beginning in the beginning of the 20th century, Jews did begin to return. A Jewish community was reestablished to some extent, but it certainly never was what it was. In 1946, the building was declared a National Historic Site. It has, in 2001, the National Trust for Historic Preservation selected Touro Synagogue to become part of its collection of historic sites. It has been refurbished, and it looks today essentially the way it looked when it was first built. So this basically is an outline of the Jews of Newport and the key role that Ezra Stiles played in recording for us what went on. By the way, his diary is available online at no cost. One of the things I find more and more helpful to me in the stuff that I do, because I have become sort of obsessed with American Jewish history, as those who have been here before know, is that so much of the old books are now available on Google, and you can download them and a click and you got it, and you can print it out and you can read it if you have the patience, or you can search through it, etc. There is a book called it just selected out the parts of his diary that deal with the Jews, and you can download it and pick out various pieces. So I thank you.
What about George Washington?
What about George Washington?
He addressed the congregation at some point. There's a plaque there.
Yes. There is a plaque there. In fact, Washington wrote letters to, first of all of the Jewish congregations congratulated Washington on his becoming president, etc. And he wrote this famous letter guaranteeing religious freedom, indeed. But I don't think he ever slept in the Touro Synagogue. That I don't think. Anyone else have a question?
I have a question. I thought you were going to connect this synagogue, which I've been in, with Roger Williams' philosophy. The fact that there were no synagogues in other parts of the country, was that because of prejudice, or just people just never got around to it?
Well, first of all, it's not true that there were no synagogues in other parts of the country.
Oh, I thought you were saying that.
No. The Touro Synagogue is the oldest building that we still have.
Oh, original.
Original. But there were other. First of all, in New York there was a synagogue, in Richmond, in Savannah, in Charleston, okay, in Charleston, in Philadelphia, okay, there were synagogues. We're talking now during colonial times and then into the 19th century. What is interesting is that every synagogue that was founded in America originally was founded based on the Spanish-Portuguese ritual. Even though in many communities the majority of the Jews may have been Ashkenaz, which is non-Sephard, non-Spanish-Portuguese, yet that tradition continued until, I think, in 1830-something or something like that. The first Ashkenaz, which is non-Oriental synagogue, was established here, B'nai Yeshurun, in Manhattan. But until then, everything was modeled after the Spanish-Portuguese. Amsterdam had a big influence on these people. They often turned to Amsterdam had a vibrant Jewish community, and Amsterdam had qualified rabbis to answer religious questions. And so they corresponded often with Amsterdam. Okay, and the Sherith Israel Synagogue is supposedly built on the idea of the way the Amsterdam Synagogue is, which is exists. I never saw it, but which is still there today. So, but no, I'm sorry if I gave that impression. That's not true. There were other synagogues. There were other synagogues throughout.
Was there any early resistance to building them among all these persons?
First of all, it depends which state. Maryland had anti-Jewish laws running into the 1800s. You had to, in order to have an office in Maryland, you had to swear allegiance to Christianity, to the Trinity. If you weren't, if you criticized the Trinity, you weren't willing to swear allegiance to Christianity, then you couldn't hold an office. Okay, the synagogue in Manhattan was not built right away because they waited till they got permission. I'm sure you know that Peter Stuyvesant wasn't happy when the Jews came. He tried to get rid of them. But even when the British took over, in some other places, you have earlier synagogues built in the islands, in the Caribbean islands, because there things were less restrictive, interestingly enough. But there were, in a sense, that there was some resistance. But on the other hand, America is one of the few countries that actually welcomed the Jews. Not that Peter Stuyvesant did, but in general, Jews were treated fairly decently. And not that there are incidents of anti-Semitism. I believe I spoke about Rabbi Jacob Joseph and his funeral, which was a big anti-Semitic thing. And I spoke about the blood libel in Messina, which was also something else. But nonetheless, in general, America has been good to the Jews. America has been very good to the Jews. Okay, and that's a big plus. Most other countries were not at all. Were not at all. In Bavaria, in the 1820s and 30s, there was a law that said that only the oldest Jewish son could marry, because they wanted to restrict the number of Jews. And how could a younger brother marry? Only if he paid some huge tax to marry. Also, Jews were restricted to being peddlers in the cattle trade. They couldn't do anything else. Net result? Mass migration from Bavaria to America beginning in the late 1830s and 1840s. That's the original German Jews who came. They came from Bavaria. So life was not easy. Sal?
Larry, you mentioned earlier the presence of distilleries and the Jewish community obviously owned some of these distilleries. The distillers were one of the leaders of the revolution because of the sugar tax.
Yes.
And the impact that had on businesses.
Yes.
Did you find any of the members of the Jewish community actually sort of rabble-rousing and playing a leadership role here in terms of organizing people?
There's no question. They signed, first of all, the declarations. Then there's a gentleman by the name of Mordechai Schefftel. The name probably doesn't ring a bell. Who is from Savannah, Georgia. His parents came here in 1733, the first Jews to settle in Savannah. He was born here in 1735. He was a colonel in the Revolutionary War. Okay, he's the highest Jewish ranking officer. He was also an Orthodox Jew, interestingly enough. So, yes, Jews were very much involved. They were very much involved. He's rare in the sense that he reached that height. I spoke about, I don't remember anyway. There's a gentleman named Jacob Mordechai who started the first female academy, a pioneering educational endeavor in America in about 1810. It was thought that women couldn't study the same subjects as men. Their minds were too delicate, and it would, you know, who knows what would happen. And he opened up a female academy, which he gave a first-class secular education. And his father fought in the Revolutionary War Army. Plus, there were others. The Phillips family fought, okay, and were involved in it. Yes, the Jews took it out. First of all, the fact that they were merchants was something that led them out, because they didn't want the taxes. They didn't want the tax. And also, they knew what oppression was, and they certainly didn't want any more. Anyone else? Yes, Jim.
What's the Hebrew on the Yale? Is it Lux and Veritas in Hebrew?
No. Lux and Veritas, as we said, means light and truth. Urim v'tumim. Now, Urim v'tumim, that's part the high priest in the temple wore a certain breastplate. And part of that is something called the Urim v'tumim. Okay. Why he chose that to put on there, I have no idea.
Well, the thing itself is called that. It doesn't.
Well, part of it is. Part of it.
It doesn't say anything else, and the words don't mean anything else.
The words really can't be translated. They're called the Urim v'Tumim, and this was used. The Bible says that this was consulted. For example, when it came to dividing the land, when Joshua conquered the land of Israel, the Urim v'Tumim were consulted in terms of how to divide it, which tribe should get what, where, and how. So this has religious significance. Mm-hmm. But this was part of the vestments. Yeah, was part of the vestments of the high priest.
I got you. Okay. Would it be a mark of authority? Would it convey authority?
Oh, yes, for sure. Mm-hmm. For
maybe
sure.
That's why they chose.
Maybe I don't. They. It's him. It's Styles. I don't know. I didn't happen to come across why he chose it. I honestly don't know. Okay, why he chose those words, but he clearly had become a Hebrew scholar. I mean, to be able to deliver an inauguration address as president, I don't know who else understood him. I just don't know. I mean,
some of the theologians.
Presumably, yes. Yes, some of the theologians. Yes, 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 yes. Sir?
Presumably the great diarist wrote about his choice.
It may be, but I didn't see it. It may well be. It may well be. I don't know. But the diary deals with Jews up until the revolution. And then when he left Newport, because he ran away like the others, he ran away, many ran away from the British. After that, he had very limited contact with Jews. And I don't know, maybe it's there, but it's certainly not. The selection I looked at was his writings about the Jews. That's a separate book. I didn't look at the diaries. Are huge. Diaries apparently huge. Anyone else?
Larry, I want to reinforce the point you were making about the architectural beauty of the temple, of the synagogue there in Newport. It is magnificent.
Yeah, it is. It's simple. It's quote unquote clean. And but yet it's beautiful. It's beautiful. It's functional. It doesn't have all this fancy junk on the walls or anything like that. It is a classically beautiful building. Yes, yes, yes. Then I want to thank you all. Thank you.